former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Good evening, folks. Welcome back to the beautiful studios of the Big Dumb Fun Show, Studio 4, right here in Midtown Kansas City in the classic old Ice House building. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
We're going to try something different. This is this is going to be a bonus episode. This will be the second one we have in the bag. We have done dramatic readings. I did one on the killing of the two Charlies, and Aaron did one on the murder of John Lazia. Now, these are kind of old crimes, and a lot of you guys may not have even heard of these people, but they were the mob people in Kansas City from the old days in the 20s and 30s all the way up to the 50s, just as our most recent mob boss, who is dead now, Nick Civella, took over.
Now, and the headlines are actually true newspaper stories written
Right.
from the day.
Right. I got this service that I got to pay a little bit each month for, and I go back and I can Google or not Google, but keyword these names in, and then go find all the newspaper articles that they're mentioned in. I knew about these crimes, and so that's what I was looking for. I just typed in John Lazia and 1934, because I knew he was killed in 1934, and then I pulled up all the newspapers that talked about that. Some of them are the Kansas City paper, some of them are the Boonville paper, some of them are the Jefferson City paper. I even have one as far away as, I think, St. Petersburg, Florida. And back in those days, there's a big crime like this, these other newspapers all around the country would just get a copy of the Kansas City Star article and basically block, copy, and paste it into their own newspaper. Now, they didn't block and copy and paste. They retyped it, I'm sure. But it's exact same language in all the different newspapers. It's been kind of interesting doing that. I found a lot of fun stuff doing this, actually.
Well, they wouldn't really be able to get, I mean, they may be able to make a phone call, and who would they call? Maybe like the local reporter.
Yeah.
Or, you know, maybe they'd make a reach out to the local, you know, prosecutor or the police department
Police department.
And identify themselves as a reporter asking for information, and how much information they're going
to
get.
They're not going to talk to them. Plus, if you think about it, this was, you know, this was the old days. This is when you got a long distance bill, and you have to watch that long distance bill. Remember that? Remember that, Aaron?
I remember
that. You'd
be
talking on the telephone long distance to your mom, and your mom would say, "Now we better get off now. This is long distance."
I had to pay by the minute.
I think my mom still would do that if she'd get on the phone.
I remember when they had the party line.
The party? Oh, yeah, I do, too. Don't
want
to give
away
our
age.
We're just showing our age. Yeah. What was our first phone had a crank on it, Aaron? I can top you. I can top any old story that you got about telephones. We had a crank, two longs and a short, and on a party line.
That was your crank.
That was the crank. Now, you cranked it too short. You would crank it real slowly, and that was a long. So you would crank it real slowly around once and twice, and you crank it real fast. Maybe not even quite get all the way at the end, and that was a short. So people had like two shorts and a long, or two longs and a short, or
you really
long,
had to be
short,
listening,
long,
didn't
you?
You
had to be listening.
Like,
yes,
if the phone
did.
Was going to ring, it's like, what was that? Two longs and a short, or three longs?
Hey, here's one, Aaron. That little fun fact.
I think that
about
was
myself.
Five shorts. That was the doorbell, Grandpa.
Yeah, really. But the first time I was a victim of a crime. This is a crime show. The first time I was victim of a crime, it was, I guess you would call it telephone harassment, although more it was like a telephone prank. We got a call. I answered the phone. I was probably, I don't know, 9 or 10 years old. And this voice, very official sounding voice, said, son, I'm so-and-so with Southwestern Bell Telephone Company. We have a problem with the lines, and we're going to blow them out. Now, what I need you to do is the kitchen close by? Yeah, it's right here next to the phone. Well, get a tea towel and lay it over the phone, because when we blow these phone lines out, why, it's going to blow dust all out in your house, and this will contain the dust. So I dutifully hung up and went in and got a tea towel and laid it over the phone and then stood back and watched.
And nothing happened.
Nothing happened. That guy on the other end. Of course, he didn't really have the satisfaction other than I told him that I was going to do that. He knew he had me fooled. So he had some satisfaction. He'd had even more satisfaction if he'd seen this little boy standing back waiting for the dust to blow out of the phone. So I think I told my mom later that day, or my dad or something.
They're like, how come there's a tea towel over the phone?
Really?
Well, one of the servicemen called, and they were saying they were blowing the dust out, and...
I felt like an idiot, but...
Yeah, because it's not like they had caller ID back then.
Right, absolutely right. No caller ID.
But you would hear other people's crank calls, right? Not their calls, but like someone would have me, well, I'm two shorts and a long.
If the party line...
And in the party line, it would ring two shorts and a long, and everybody heard the ring, right?
Right, and you knew who it was, so you'd jump on the phone and listen to their phone conversations.
Listen, that was what we did on the party line at my grandparents'.
That was my first wiretap experience.
My grandfather would come in for dinner. That's what they called lunch.
Right,
out on the farm.
Yes.
And usually afterwards, he'd sit in the living room there and listen with, oddly enough, it was an old sort of a rotary phone. It wasn't quite that old, but he would hold the part you're talking to up away from his mouth, I guess just in case
it
could hear.
Yeah.
Never understood that.
Well, and anyhow, so moving right along.
So we have these stories that Gary Jenkins ripped from the headlines, as we call it.
Right. And this is going to be a dramatic reading of some stories about John Lazy. Now, let me tell you a little bit about John Lazy, or Lazy. I think it's Lazy, actually. We're probably pronouncing it like a couple of hillbillies.
Didn't they always, on the tombstone, Lazy. It's with an A and not with an O?
No, and on the tombstone, it's with an O.
Which is the family would say that's the correct spelling.
And Savella's the same way. It's with an O. But everybody always called him John Lazy. It's Lazia, and I have a good friend, my good friend Joe from Florida. Matter of fact, Joe played Johnny Lazia in the Robert Altman film, Kansas City.
Kansas City.
They had a character who was purportedly John Lazia. Lazia. I need to try to get that somewhat right. I'm supposed to be this mob expert, John Lazia. You know, he has that suburban lake home out in... Lake Tappawingo, or was it Latawana? I think it was Tappawingo. We talked about that before, and it's a beautiful home. I've seen pictures of it. It's a huge, big, beautiful home, just perfect, pristine condition even to this day. It was for sale not too long ago. A friend of mine went through it and took some pictures of it. I don't know what happened. I had those pictures, and I can't remember what I did with them. He also, he lived in the city. He had what we call a residential hotel room. Back in those days, there was a lot of high rises mainly along Armour out in, not too far from here, few blocks from here.
About, part of Midtown.
About 6-8 blocks from here, there's about a 10 block long, all along Armour Boulevard from Broadway to Truce, there's all these big old apartment buildings, and a lot of them were actually hotels. They called them hotels. They had, because they had a doorman and a guy behind the desk there, and I guess you could go in and even get a room, short-term room once in a while. I don't really know. I know.
But they were probably more like apartments.
But they were more like apartments. They called it a hotel. This was right down from the Belrive Hotel, which was mainly apartments, but it was also a hotel. Belrive is about a block away, and it was purportedly, it had a club in it, and they had gambling in the club, and this is a place that Al Capone, when he came to Kansas City, liked to go party and gambling at the Belrive Hotel.
Now, do you have that in the Kansas City Mob Tour app?
No, I don't. I have the Johnny Lazy's old home. I didn't put the Belrive in.
You might have to add that.
Might want to add that little tidbit about Al Capone. That's the only thing that makes it interesting. I had an informant once that talked about when he was a kid or a young man, he used to go down there and shoot dice, and he got caught cheating once, and he had to run out. He actually left town. His hands were huge, and he could palm an extra set of dice, and so he could throw out he could switch off. He could get the house dice, and he would have
loaded dice
that looked just like that, and he could switch them off in his hands, but he got caught. And he went to Denver, Colorado for several months after he got caught at the Belrive. He was old-time kind of, hanger-on around the mob and hustler and all that when he was young. He was more like a legitimate businessman when I knew him.
You don't think they were suspicious he comes in with these really big hands?
Well,
why has he rolled the dice in his hands in a cup for so long?
Really?
They went in red. They came out black dice. I'm not sure.
That will get you hurt there.
I mean, how does he? I guess maybe he'd been in there. He's like, oh, that's the kind of dice they're using.
He knows. Well, he knew what
I'm
kind of dice
have to go buy some.
When he was there. Yes, he did. And he didn't actually drop the dice. I think somebody like tried to grab his hand because they were suspicious, and he pulled away. And he's a big guy, and he pulled away and just shoved him down, and then just beat feet and got on out of there because he knew he got away with the evidence. But he left town for quite a while after that. So anyhow, John Lazy, he was really, and he was Pendergast's right hand man. He had the North End or the First Ward Democratic Club and controlled all the votes. In a lot of votes in black neighborhoods and all the votes in the Italian neighborhood, while Pendergast controlled all the votes in the Irish neighborhoods and over in the West Bottoms and all down through Midtown, which was the majority of the votes. And then you had the Silk Stocking area, and that was primarily English heritage people. They were the ones that were always the Silk Stocking people were always trying to clean up the corrupt politics, but, you know, they didn't mind doing business with Pendergast either, and they didn't mind buying their beer at the whiskey at the speakeasies and having that available. So it was kind of one hand washes the other. Everybody was kind of in cahoots in some ways here during Prohibition. Lazia had joined together with Pendergast after he had fought with him a little bit, and Pendergast brought him in. And Pendergast thought so much of him. Everybody liked him. He was real well known and real well liked. Big, tall, good looking guy. He was given an office in police headquarters. I actually have an old report, not a report, a letter on police stationery, talking about hiring somebody. And at the bottom it says, "Okay, John Lazia." So he swung a pretty big stick in Kansas City politically, but he was also basically the head of the mob. He would be the godfather in 1934 when he died. He was the recognized head of the La Cosa Nostra Mafia. There was other people under him that did all the work, all the, you know, dirty work. He didn't do any dirty work himself by this point in time.
But he was well known as that person.
Yes, he was well known.
Well enough known that other people that were trying to come up in the world of the mob,
right, like,
decided to do something about it.
There had been a hit about a year before that on a guy named Ferris Anthon just a few blocks away on Armor. This is about 300 block west and about 1,500 block west. Charlie Gargatta and Tano Lococo, Sammy Scola, and I can't remember the fourth guy's name, they did kill a bar owner who was aligned with this other faction of a guy named Lusco, L-U-S-C-O. He was aligned with that faction, and they killed him because he was aligned with this other faction, and he wasn't giving the Lazia faction any money, more than likely. We don't never know for sure. And they know that Gargatta and Lococo did it, who were direct underlings of John Lazia, because the sheriff at the time, Sheriff Tom Bash, drove up on it and caught him in the act and had a gun battle with him and killed Sam Scola and arrested Charlie Gargatta right there and took the guns off of him that killed Ferris Anthon, and they caught Tano Lococo running away a few blocks later.
And killed him.
A few blocks away. No, they didn't kill Tano Lococo. The police didn't. He gave up. The only person that got killed was Ferris Anthon and Sam Scola. The sheriff killed Sam Scola, who was a wheelman for the hit guys, for Gargatta and Lococo. They got out. Sam Scola was driving the car. They pulled up behind or across the street or next to this Ferris Anthon who had just gotten his car. They ran over the car, Lococo and Gargatta, with two stolen government pistols, which there's a big theft of pistols and machine guns from an armory here in Kansas City, and they kept popping up in mob hits all over the place for several years. So probably, you know, it was probably something out of that. There was somebody making a move on Lazia. It was probably this Lesko.
Gangland Wire presents True Crime Writ From the headline,
Jefferson City Post Tribune, Tuesday, July 10th, 1934. Pendergast aide expires 11 hours after shooting. Three blood transfusions fail to save Democratic chief. Wife, friend, escape, volley which killed. Unknown man poured withering fire into body of politician. Kansas City, Missouri, July 10th. John Lazia, who rose from a lowly station in the Northside Italian colony to become a power in Kansas City's Democratic political machine, died today, the victim of machine gun bullets fired at him from ambush by two gangsters. He died in the St. John's Hospital 11 hours after his assassins fired 8 bullets into the body as he stepped from the sedan to the pavement in front of his Armor Boulevard Hotel. The attack occurred shortly before dawn. Victim of gangland feuds in which his name often had been lingering both as a political lieutenant and underworld power, died without naming his assailants. While Lazia lay on his deathbed today, the police department, in which many of the members credited their job to the dead chief's influence, was carrying out perhaps the most systematic roundup of suspects in the city's criminal history. But within 2 hours after the shooting, police, at the command of Director Otto P. Higgins, aroused Joe Lesko, an Italian and flower shop proprietor, from his bed. Lazia, under federal conviction for failing to file income tax returns, and his wife and two friends, or Charles Carolla and his wife, stopped their car in front of the Armor Boulevard Hotel when two gangsters arose from behind an ambush of shrubbery lawn chairs and a retaining wall.
Charlie Carollo, who was his driver, will go on and be the immediate boss. He got away. He might, you might suspect him if he wanted to get rid of Lazian and take over as boss. Pretty interesting. They were coming in. It was just before dawn. They'd been out all night long.
Well, I'm kind of wondering. I mean, obviously, Johnny Lazia did not identify who the men were, but do you think he knew who they were?
More than likely. Kansas City's not that big a town. And especially then, in 1934, those hoodlums would all known each other, unless they imported somebody. They could have brought somebody in from out of town.
And why did they rouse Tana Lococo?
Joe Lesko.
Joe Lesko.
Because he had his own little criminal group, and intelligence at the time said he was in a dispute over some rights to speakeasies and gambling and things like that with John Lazia. And he was not really kowtowing to the Lazia faction.
So it made him making him a prime suspect.
In a mob hit, there's always a prime suspect. When you hit a boss, you look for, like in modern times, when if Nick Civella had gotten killed, they'd be immediately gone after the Spiro brothers, because we knew that there was already bad blood between mm-hmm. them. They were having their own action. They were not paying any money, any tribute or any street tax, kicking anything, letting them wet their beak, if you will, to the Civellas. And so in true mob fashion, he did not reveal his killers if he knew them. I would be willing to bet that he knew who they were.
And St. John's Hospital, where is that? Is that,
well, you know,
is that
not, I think
no
that
might
existence? Have been a misprint. I think it was St. Joseph's Hospital, which was at Linwood and Prospect.
Now, some of this,
these old articles are really hard to read.
They're really tiny, and then you kind of have to, if you had it as a PDF, you can really zoom in. But
Even on the computer screen, some of them are kind of smeared looking when they, I think it was St. Joseph's Hospital, which is at Linwood and Prospect, which would make sense. That would be the closest hospital.
Except but that hospital's not there anymore.
No, it's not there. They tore it down.
So does it seem to you that they were just being... not being careful? Because, I mean, they knew that things were going on, obviously, that if there was a feud going on, wouldn't they? They had a driver who got, Johnny Lazia's wife out of there.
And the driver had his own wife in the car. So it was like they were out partying. They'd probably been up at his joint at Cuban Gardens. If you remember, we may or may not have talked about it. Lazia had a a joint about this time called the Cuban Gardens up north of the river that was one of these old time, what they called a carpet joint. They used to call these carpet joints. They would be like a country club in an old house, maybe out in the county, outside the city limits of the city, so you didn't have local police to deal with. You only had the county sheriff. You only had to pay one guy to operate, and that was in that time in Platte County, it was the county sheriff, and they had no problem paying him off. He didn't really care.
And they called that a carpet joint?
Called it a carpet joint. So they would have a nice club up front. They'd have tuxedoed waiters and white tablecloths and nice good entertainment and good food, and then there would be gambling in the back. So he had that Cuban Gardens, which was up close to the racetrack that Pendergast went to over in Riverside.
Once again, I have to ask, is this in the Kansas City Mob Tour app?
Well, the Cuban Gardens is long gone. That I looked that up. That is like highway now up north, just like the old river, the Riverside racetrack. They've redone all that so much you can't even tell. The only reason I know, there's a guy that got some old aerial maps done in the 50s, and you could see some outlines of some of these things.
The remains of the structures.
Not aerial mass, but aerial photos. Oval of the racetrack, you could see, and then you've got a modern or an old photo, and you could kind of see that that's where it was. And same with this Cuban Gardens, you could kind of see where something had been there, but nothing was there anymore. Plus, there was a highway that went, Nine Highway, comes up out of North Kansas City, went right over
the top of that.
That would have been quite a deal to be able to go to one of those old carpet joints and
see what that was like.
See what that was like.
Well, the story continues. This news article is pretty lengthy.
As the Democratic leader, reputed lieutenant of Tom Pendergast, Missouri political boss, stepped to the driveway, a blast of gunfire roared. 20 shots followed. The rat-a-tat-tat of the machine gun being punctuated by the deep boom of the shotgun. Lazia sank to the pavement. Corolla, who was driving the machine, pushed Mrs. Lazia, who was in the rear seat, and Mrs. Corolla, who was in the front seat, to the floor. Then he shot the car out of the driveway and cut back eastward on Armor Boulevard. He returned a few minutes later. Meanwhile, Lazia, whose name often had been mentioned in gangland shootings, was lying prostrate on the pavement, calling for help. "Help me," he cried. "Help. Help me. Oh, my God. Help me."
Now, didn't the neighbors see or hear anything?
Yeah, we're gonna hear about one of them in a minute.
That sure. Just seems like, not that... It's Midtown, Kansas City, but it's the 30s. Is there that much rapid gunfire and shotgun fire on a regular basis? There is now.
There is now. That would be, no, you wouldn't even look up.
But back in the 30s.
Back in the 30s, yeah. Everybody would have been roused up, and they did rouse people up.
And you would think, because everyone probably knew that was Johnny Lazia that was living there.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure everybody did.
It was no secret.
Everybody knew. They knew.
Maybe that's where Corolla took the ladies.
Well, he just zipped. That's a circular driveway. If you think about it, they drive up and you drop people off underneath an awning and then drive on out and go around back and park in the parking lot in the back. And that's what he was doing. He was pulling up and they're probably just going to let the women out. And then he would be driving around to the parking lot. Only Lazy had probably had got out to let his wife out. I got a feeling. He got out, and they knew what he looked like, and they were just, there's some shrubbery, and they were right on the corner of the building, and behind the shrubbery and the retaining wall, and they just jumped out and started popping as soon as he stepped out of that car. More than likely, he would have let the women out, got back in, and they'd gone and parked it, or maybe he would have escorted the women in, and Charlie would have gone ahead and parked it, but that's what they were doing. He just shoved him down and just floored it. Went around the circle almost and came right back.
Probably lucky that none of the women were hit.
Yeah, yeah. It was a pretty surgical strike, shall we say. They were using, I think one of them was a machine gun, an actual .45 caliber Thompson machine gun. They called a military machine pistol, I think they called it. Usually you don't say machine with gun without being fully automatic. And the only thing I can think of at the time in 1930s was the old grease Thompson. Gun, Thompson machine gun, which all the gangsters used, and they got them from the military. Actually, you could buy them back then. They were for sale in hardware stores back then. Oh, it's, if you look up the history of the Thompson machine gun, it's pretty interesting why it was made and kind of a self-defense device, supposedly, kind of some of the same arguments that we have today about guns. And they were selling them out of hardware stores. You could buy them anywhere. That's when all the mobsters started using them, and places like this and the Valentine's Day Massacre up in Chicago, they used some machine guns. And a lot, and especially in Chicago, they used a lot of machine guns.
Didn't they use it in the Union Station
Massacre? Union Station, they had one. So that's when the feds, the government came out with they didn't ban them. They restricted them in the military, but you could still buy them. But they put a $500 tax on it. You had to buy a $500 tax stamp in order to buy a fully automatic weapon. And then I think
that at least discouraged the general public.
That would discourage all the general public.
Yeah, but the general public wasn't the people that were probably out rampaging around shooting off their, you know, Thompson machine gun.
And the mobsters weren't going to buy them legally anyhow. They were going to steal them from somebody.
Or they had $500.
Or they had $500. They could get a straw man to go
buy one for him.
Get the stamp for him and buy it for him and give it to him.
Dr. Charles F. Lowry, a resident of the hotel living on the ground floor, was awakened by the first blast of the machine gun. He thrust his head out of the window and asked, "What's wrong?" "Help me," Lazia called. "For God's sakes, help me." "Who are you?" the physician asked, and the wounded man gave his name. Dr. Lowry donned a bathrobe and rushed to Lazia's side. Meanwhile, W.R. Peterson, the night clerk, had reached Lazia's side. When the first shot came, Peterson, thinking that gunmen were firing at him, dived to the floor, breaking his wristwatch and cutting his arm. Lazia was taken immediately to St. Joseph's Hospital. There it was found. 8 bullets had pierced his body. His right arm was broken below the shoulder by a bullet. His elbow was fractured. There was a superficial wound in the right chest, a second in the right shoulder. Another bullet had pierced his thigh and entered the groin. The 7th bullet fractured Lazia's lower jaw, but the wound, which physicians believed might be fatal, was the one in the center of the back. This bullet, physicians said, apparently had struck the spinal cord and passed into the abdomen, where it caused internal hemorrhages. The shooting occurred but 6 blocks west of the Steuben Club, where 11 months ago, Ferris Anton, underworld character and nightclub operator, was shot and killed by gangsters. 2 of the assassins were slain by Sheriff Tom Bash, who happened upon the scene of the shooting. A 3rd suspect, Charles Gargotta, was arrested, but recently he was acquitted on the murder charge. The attack on Lazia apparently had been laid carefully. Residents of the hotel recalled that 2 days ago they saw a man walk back and forth in front of the hotel, apparently noting the landscape. On the east side of the hotel is a retaining wall. Between the wall and the hotel is a grassy plot where the janitor was sleeping early today. Apparently, the gunman walked over to the janitor and took up a position at the foot of the retaining wall, further shielded by some lawn chairs and shrubs. One hotel guest saw a Ford V8 car bearing Kansas license plates driving up to the alley back of the hotel. The motor of the car was kept running. The witness did not see anyone leave the car, but one man remained at the steering wheel. It was but a few moments after the car arrived until guns roared. The next second, the witness saw 2 men run to the car, jump in, and the machine drove off rapidly, turning on Warwick Boulevard. A fully loaded U.S. automatic pistol that had either been lost or thrown away was found in the bushes where the men hid. In the Anton slaying almost a year ago, the tracing of the stolen government pistol figured into the prosecution's. A heel print where the assailant stood was discovered. A score of empty cartridges were picked up by police. Lawn chairs on the west side of the hotel lawn were scarred by bullets. A brick wall was nicked by slugs. One bullet struck the adjacent Belle Reve Hotel.
Boy, Aaron, would you say that newspaper reporter had a pretty good source inside that hospital? He got every one of those wounds described by somebody right away. This is the very next day after this happened.
Yeah, do they normally release that kind of medical information no. after somebody's been shot and then there's a crime committed?
No, not
at
normally.
Least not today.
Not today. Not
I mean
today.
That the guy must have been really tough. Look how many rounds he took. Took a shot in the groin, a shot in the chin.
Plus, you wouldn't
paralyzed, from a shot to the. I guess if it went into, I'm assuming it went in his back. Like he must have turned around and
probably spun him around. Probably hit him in the shoulder and spun him in the back.
How did the shots? They end up with the chips on the retaining wall.
They must have been
shooting.
But
they must have been shooting back.
No, I don't think there was never a report that I've ever read where anybody was shooting back at him. I think they both had machine guns, and they just let them rip.
And it shot up the lawn chairs, the retaining wall.
Yes.
John Lazia.
Those machine guns, once they start going, they start climbing on you. The barrel just starts going up and up.
They got quite a kick on if it's a .45.
It's got a pretty good kick, too. Mainly, if you're going to shoot a machine gun and do it correctly, you need to do like a 3-round burst and then stop.
Yeah, or saw the barrel off like Martin McNally.
Yeah, well, that was a shotgun. No, that's right. It wasn't a shotgun. That wasn't really a machine.
M3, but it was a .45.
Really machine gun. It was a .45. It wasn't really a machine gun.
It wasn't a Thompson, that's for sure.
He might have had something to do with this. He talked about his grease gun, how he had something look like a grease gun. I guess he's too young.
Yeah, that's a different era.
A different era.
But the fact that these guys just sort of lingered around and nobody thought anything of it till after.
Yeah, like, I know.
And then because there was a getaway car, so the two-man team, if you will, that gunned him down, do you think they maybe, because the car was there, they weren't just waiting there, you think maybe they were tailing him?
Somebody had to be. Somebody knew.
Because it wasn't like the guys were sitting out waiting in behind the lawn chairs and retaining wall, and the getaway guy was sitting in the car just letting it idle while they waited for.
Right, just wait for him to come home. Either that or, you never know. I don't know what kind of pattern he had. He may have had a regular pattern of going out on a particular night. Mm-hmm. I didn't look to see what night of the week this was. And he always, after a joint closed up, say at 3 o'clock, like Johnny Green. We had a guy killed named Johnny Green or John Amaro. His regular pattern on a Friday night, he'd close his joint. He would meet Joe Camisano, Willie Ratt's brother, mm-hmm. at Sambo's Restaurant. It used to be Sambo's Restaurant. They changed the names of those here a few years ago because of the connotation of
the racial issue.
Racial issue. But it was called Sambo's, and they would meet there for breakfast every Friday night after their joints closed, which would be about 2 o'clock. They'd eat till about 3, and then they'd drive home. So, see, he and Charlie Carollo may have had that kind of a pattern. You don't know for sure.
Yeah.
But if you had that pattern, then they'd just go and lay in wait. They'd already watched him like 2 Friday nights or 3 Friday nights or 3 Thursday nights or Saturday nights, watch him 3 or 4 of those weeks in a row, and see that he pulled up in the driveway and he got out and then let the women out. And then, or he and his wife got out and Charlie Carollo and his wife went on, but he saw he had that pattern. So you just lay in wait and just park the car out and back about 2:30 or so. Say if he comes in at 3:30, you just, park the car out and back and, then about that time, just slip on up alongside the building, just mm-hmm. sit there until you saw the headlights, come up the street.
They probably knew what kind of car he had.
And it's far enough back, they knew what kind of car he had, and it's far enough back off the street that you would see, you would have enough time really to get ready. You would have a good minute from the time he started into the driveway.
Got out and came around to let his wife out.
Right.
And of course, then the guy that is, this is like a resident hotel. And who's the guy that yells out at him but a doctor?
A doctor, yeah, he lives there. Can you imagine the night clerk? He's diving for cover. He thinks they're shooting at him.
I mean, after giving the detail, he scratched his arm.
Yeah.
It seems a little, Johnny Lazia got 7 or 8 rounds in him. Night clerk scratched his arm. Lucky guy.
They're big on those details back in 1934, the newspapers. That's what's kind of fun about reading these newspapers.
Maybe, I try to give it a little bit of a dramatic read, but I'm just doing radio voice like that. It just doesn't seem quite...
It's hard to do.
Maybe what I need to do is put my hand over my nose and pitch my nose so I could sound like an old time, how about a shout out for the troops?
Yeah, or something like, two men lurk behind the shrubbery and the retaining wall, they sprang into action and gunned down John Lazia.
This just in. Attack on Lazia apparently had been laid carefully. Residents of the hotel recalled 2 days ago they saw men walking back and forth in front of the hotel.
Da 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 da. I want to get some of that Untouchables music. I wish I could find something music like that Untouchables. I guess we can't steal their music if iTunes catches me.
Yeah, you don't want to do that.
Stealing somebody's music, they kick us off.
We know some musicians. We got to find something like that. Well, we got a little bit more here left here. Let's see.
All right, go ahead.
From the Jefferson City Post-Tribune, Tuesday, July 10th, 1934. In an article entitled, Tell Tom Pendergast I Love Him, from Kansas City, Missouri, July 10th, John Lazia, Northside political leader, died today after a third blood transfusion. He was shot down in front of his hotel home by gangsters. Prosecuting attorney W.W. Graves Jr. went to his bedside to take his statement. The investigators were told by Dr. D.M. Nigro that Lazia had told him, I don't know why they did it. I'm a friend of everybody. I don't know why they did this to me. If anything happens, notify Tom Pendergast, my best friend. Tell him I love him. From the Jefferson City Post-Tribune, Tuesday, July 10th, 1934. Grim Italians guard hospital. Democratic chief's followers watch. Priest comfort Mrs. Lazia. Kansas City, Missouri, July 10th. 100 grim-faced Italians today stood guard at the entrance to the St. Joseph Hospital, where their leader, John Lazia, a power in Northside Democratic politics, battled for his life. They assembled quickly after word was passed that Lazia was shot down by two gangsters in front of his Armor Boulevard Hotel home just before 3 a.m. The self-appointed guards sat quietly in a large motor car drawn up before the hospital. There was no evidence of arms, but they scrutinized everyone who entered or left the hospital door. It was apparent they were guarding against any efforts of Lazia's assailants to return to the hospital to finish their job. Inside the hospital, 100 or more Italian men and women prayed incessantly for the recovery of their leader. Occasionally, a small group would edge up to the door of the room where physicians examined the 8 wounds in Lazia's body. There, they would pause, cross themselves, and move on. Further up the hallway, others wept audibly. Beside the operating room door, Mrs. Lazia, attractive brunette wife of the wounded man, sat conferring with a priest, one of those summoned to administer last rites. She was hysterical.
Land Wire, true crime, ripped from the headlines.
Well, Aaron, you know, one thing I forgot to mention that clip before this is the crime scene and how they treated the crime scene. Apparently, reporters were probably just walking up. You know, today, the first patrolman, the district officer, beat officer, the first one that gets there at any kind of shooting, immediately, if there's nothing, you order ambulances, but there's nothing else to do and nothing that's ongoing, the suspects are gone, you immediately get out the yellow tape and create a crime scene, a pretty good-sized crime scene. I don't think they did that here. I don't think they blocked off the crime scene at all. And they just walked around and picked up the shell casings. You know, now they take a little marker for each shell casing.
They mark where it's at.
Mark where it's at. Take a picture. Maybe draw a circle around it. Take a picture of that and to draw an exact picture and literally draw an exact picture of the crime scene as it.
Yeah, then
besides the pictures.
You had shared a photo, not a photo, the photo from the Democratic Club of the two Charlies, but there was a actual, like a crime scene.
Crime scene, a guy's laying there dead, and there's a cab driver sitting there in a chair about 3 feet from him. Yes, they were not big on scientific evidence back then.
Well, and I mean, so there's all these guys, if you will, in cars or, you know, Italian people in the hallways of the of the hospital a little late, isn't it?
Well, they
like, where were those guys all these times that he was Johnny was pulling up to his, you know, home hotel and sitting out guarding there? Because if he was that notorious,
well, if they knew it was going to happen, they probably would have been there. It's like apparently he was a little bit relaxed. He didn't really think that anybody would shoot him. As he said, what did he tell the doc? He said,
"Why would anybody do this to me?
I'm a friend to everybody."
Except that guy down on 39th or whatever it was that didn't pay his...
Parasanthon.
Parasanthon who didn't wet his beak.
Yes, and Joe Lesko, he was not a friend to them, so he wasn't a friend to everybody. It's really interesting that, I mean, in the paper, think about it, and that other one we did on the Gargatta, how Gargatta... The governor of the state of Missouri talked about how this mobster, Charlie Gargatta, who's one of the pallbearers here and the suspect in the Ferris Anthon murder, and not only the suspect, he did it. He just beat the case because they were so corrupt back then. And Gargatta becomes this politician himself by 1950, and he's able to walk in and out of the governor of the state of Missouri's office at you know, free. Just whenever he feels like, and the governor won't even say anything about it other than he just dropped by to see me. So it's, you know, politics and mafia and Kansas City and Jackson County were all intertwined, and, you know, at the state level too, we're all intertwined, and Tom Pendergast was the linchpin for all that.
Well, I mean, so the last thing that John Lazia says is tell Tom
Pendergast I love him.
What about his wife?
Tom Pendergast had probably done more for him than his wife, at least as far as his ego was concerned, and making him helping him consolidate and hold on to the power that he'd had all those years. So he had a huge amount of power. You got to understand, if you notice all those Italians, they kept talking. And would they do that today? Would they say 100 Italian people were at this guy's, you know,
hanging out inside the hospital or in the hospital.
Would they identify them as Italian?
Well, they'd be probably safer to say they were Italian than
some other things,
than
I guess.
Some other, you know,
characteristics. But just to identify somebody by their ethnicity is kind of unusual.
Awkward and odd now.
A little more awkward today. They was not that awkward back then. They were proud to be an Italian, I think. And so, you know, they were immigrants. These were children of the first people that came over here.
Yeah,
and John Lazia had become their hero because he had achieved all this political power, and then you could send your son or your brother, and you could send him to John Lazia if you knew John Lazia, and John Lazia knew that you always voted the right way, and you were willing to help his organization out in any way you could. Yeah, he'd probably get you a job as a policeman. Even you could be a convicted felon, he'd get you a job as a policeman, which he did for several of them. But he could get you a job as a cleanup guy for the city. He could get you a job as a, you know, a ticket vendor at a municipal auditorium, or, you know.
Yeah, handing out those jobs was a powerful position.
Oh, yeah.
That's why Tom Pendergast was so powerful.
Exactly, especially in 1934. You know, there was no social net. This was the social net. This was the welfare.
Yeah,
for poor people and people who are destitute. Otherwise, you could starve to death. You truly could. There was no food stamps.
Yeah,
there was no Cross Lines kitchen over
there
in Wyandotte County.
Soup kitchens.
No soup kitchens at the churches.
But you could fish in the Missouri River
back then. You could.
Not
fish.
Now. I don't know if I would do that now.
You could fish. And you could go hunting probably too, not too far away.
Yeah, you didn't have to have a license.
Or outside the city.
Well, here
and you could take a machine gun, because you could just have a machine gun.
You could just have one.
Yeah.
I'm looking here at, this is from the Wikipedia about Lazia, and it says, Lazia associates immediately blame La Capra for Lazia's murder and tried to assassinate him several times, succeeding in August of 1935.
That was Jimmy Needles La Capra.
Yeah.
He was the guy, see, that's a, if you remember, Terrence talked about him. He was the one that they kind of tried to hang the Union Station massacre on, and he gave the story that John Lazia probably approved that. And then he was hiding out from Lazia. I don't think he did not have the wherewithal or the oomph to put anything together. He was a low-level, called him Jimmy Needles because he was a heroin addict, and he did not have the organization or the oomph to put it together to try to kill somebody like Lazia.
You don't think that was actually him? Because they say he was eventually murdered in New Paltz, New York. Yeah. However,
he was hiding out in New York. They've been wanting him on. They'd been wanting to murder him ever since that whole Union Station massacre debacle went down. And he gave a statement and put Lazia as probably the guy that gave the approval and put those people together. If you remember, Terrence said, and he said, John Lazia always was having dinner at the Harvey Cafe in the Union Station. And he would have been there the night before all that happened.
Wasn't he
would have
been there the
next night, yeah. And so if when these traveling criminals like Vern Miller, Lazzi would have known Vern Miller and knew he was in town. He was a traveling bank robber. And so they came to town. They checked in with John Lazzi or somebody close to him. Pretty Boy Floyd, when he came to town, he checked in. And then the story was that, and I think Jimmy Needles was one that told it, that Lazzi kind of put them together. Vern Miller told him, said, you know, we want to break my buddy, Frank Nash, away from these U.S. Marshals or FBI agents that are taking him back to the penitentiary up in Leavenworth. They're coming through Union Station in the morning. Lazzi then put him together with Pretty Boy Floyd.
Well, a lot of people, you know, they talk about that in terms of the FBI agents being killed. But what people probably really don't know is that some of the bullets that killed them came from FBI guns.
Their own guns. I think it was from that Otto. Oh, God, I can't think of his name. First name was Otto. He was a sheriff from down in Oklahoma, I think, McAllister, Oklahoma. They had brought him along on the deal to, when they arrested, we're kind of getting off kilter here, but when they arrested this bank robber, Frank Nash, down in Hot Springs, Arkansas, the FBI arrested him. He was a bank robber and the escapee from Leavenworth. They took this sheriff from McAllister, Oklahoma, along with him because he knew what Frank Nash looked like. He'd known him for a long time. They only had pictures of him. Took him along, and so he rode with him, and he was going to ride with him all the way and help guard him all the way to the penitentiary as they get him back to Leavenworth, and they came up on the train from Hot Springs to Joplin. But so that guy had this, Terrence said that guy had this weird gun. He had some kind of a shotgun. It was a semi-automatic, but you can do things to those that make them pop two or three rounds in a row.
He had a special load in it.
And a special load.
And a hair trigger.
And a hair trigger, and it went off more than once, and he had mixed up his shotgun.
Yeah, that then the officers got confused about which gun they had.
Right.
And at the time, obviously when Pretty Boy Floyd and Frank Nash show up,
and somebody
to break him out.
Somebody panicked in the back. Somebody panicked in the back seat with that shotgun.
But you'll actually have to go back and listen to the
Wire.com Union Station massacre.
But here I'm just reading from this was the last part of the Wikipedia about Lazzi's murder. It says, however, and I don't know how true this is. This is just people put this up as it would be. However, law enforcement traced some of the bullets in Lazzi's body to bullets found in the Union Station massacre, creating suspicion that it was a Lazzia ally who murdered him. Now, yep. Is it possible because you know who succeeded Lazzia as the new boss?
Wasn't it Charlie Carollo? Didn't he?
Charlie Carollo.
He was there for a while. He may have gotten approval for that out of Chicago, for example. Because this Union Station massacre, it really brought the heat down on everybody. I mean, it was huge. I can imagine Lazzi being in trouble for approving of that, even though he had no idea that it was going to go south like it did and go wrong like it did. I could see where they would now doubt his leadership, and Carollo could maybe convince somebody, hey, we need to get rid of this guy. Let me take over, and we won't have those kinds of trouble in the future. That would be a rational, reasonable supposition on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like Nick Civella.
Yeah.
And the two Charlies.
Right. Nick comes back from Chicago, driver for Tony Gizzo. All of a sudden, the two Charlies, who are pretty well running the mob in Kansas City, they get killed. Tony Gizzo moves on up to be the boss, and Nick Civella moves right with him, and then he eventually succeeds Tony Gizzo. So, yeah, that's a pretty good supposition, too. Yeah, other stuff you got to make supposition because nobody's ever.
No one really knows for sure. I mean, looking on Wikipedia, you look at Carollo, and he was, of course, the driver for Lazy and his wife Maria, driving him to their apartment building, and when this unidentified hit team gunned him down in a hail of submachine gun fire. It says here, Lazy's last words were for Carollo to drive Maria to safety. Carollo and Maria Lazy escaped unharmed. The murder was never solved, and with the aid of the Kansas City Pendergast political organization, Carollo became the new mob boss. Carollo and the newly appointed Kansas City police chief, Otto Higgins, became closely involved in numerous criminal activities.
They were, Lazy was already in bed with, shall we say, Otto Higgins. He was a corrupt police chief put in by Pendergast. So Lazy basically told him who to hire and told him who to fire and told him what investigations to work and how to work them if he wanted to. So Carollo just moved right into that spot. Does it say how long Carollo was the mob boss?
Well, Carollo lived a long life.
He did, but he was not the boss a long time.
I'm looking. He died in 1979. And
he was deported, wasn't he?
Yeah, released from prison in 1954, Carollo was eventually deported to Italy in 1979. Carollo died of natural causes in Kansas City.
Yeah, he slipped back into the country in the 70s, and then they caught him, but he was on his deathbed, last legs.
So maybe what happened to Carollo was, here it says, in 39, the Treasury agencies under Secretary Henry Morgenthau Jr. started pursuing Carollo. Carollo responded by refusing any warrants and sending his gunmen to harass the agents. However, on October 20th, 1939, Carollo, Higgins, and Tom Pendergast were convicted of income tax evasion and sent to Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary in Leavenworth, Kansas.
Oh, Carollo was convicted with Tom Pendergast then of income tax evasion.
You know what? That probably, there's some stuff when we talk about the mob and the politician.
Yeah, could be. I can't remember.
Which is another great episode with Terrence O'Malley that we did live at the Uptown Arts Bar.
During that time, since the local police were so corrupt, the FBI were just chasing bank robbers at the time.
Not really. The organized crime and being able to fight that. Yeah, it says here, really, he was 1934 to 1939, and then Charles Bonaggio succeeded him.
And he ruled until 1950 when he was killed. All during the war, but the FBI, they were just chasing bank robbers around. Local police were doing nothing. They were part of the problem, so that's why it fell to Treasury agents and to try to get them on income tax. Treasury agents had actually been responsible for the bootlegging, but now prohibition's over. There's no cases to be made on bootlegging, so they went after him on income taxes. That's how they got Al Capone, put him in jail for income
over tax. Income tax evasion. Well, the
believe Elliot Ness was a Treasury agent.
The local authorities were corrupt, and so they couldn't get him on any of the actual criminal activities that they were really doing.
Right.
They could prove, though, that they had revenues and incomes from that they weren't paying taxes on.
I met an old-time policeman. We made a call over Northeast, and I was, brand new back in the early 70s, and this guy, 80-year-old guy, and he starts saying, I used to be a Kansas City policeman, and he kind of laughs. He said, I got in trouble once. He said, I hit some kind of a needle that you used to boot in a illegal still. I couldn't really make sense of it other than he got in huge trouble with the feds because they got him for helping out with the bootlegging is what it sounded like to me. during the prohibition, that in my app, I've got that tunnel and that wine vat that they have down in Little Italy on 534, I believe, Gillis, that the granddaughter of the people that originally came here from Italy, great-granddaughter of the ones that originally came here, and their grandfather still lives there. And she got a hold of me and said, would you be interested in seeing this? And I said, well, heck yes. And so she let me come over, and I took a picture of the specially made big vat. She said that her grandparents made wine there during the prohibition and then bottled it, and then they had this tunnel that they about got in trouble. The feds were on to them, and so they didn't want to take it up on the street and take it anywhere out of that house, and there was a tunnel underneath Gillis Street over to a neighbor's house across the street. So they took it over there and then distributed it out of there.
So there is actually some truth to the tunnels.
The tunnels, yes. There are tunnels around, over around the Coates house, and I was just reading on Facebook about that today, and there was a tunnel.
Maybe between Josephine Marlowe's house?
No, not between, not up there. Not up there around the actual Sabella's house. But I think in the olden days, that was quite common, especially between relatives' house, so you didn't have to go back outside. Old Ray Kenny, a guy that taught me everything I knew about working the mob and being an intelligence officer, said that he believed that whole tunnel story between the Sabella brothers' homes started back in the 20s or 30s, and there was two Italian men who married sisters, and they lived next door to each other in bungalows over off of Van Brunt. I think it was on Van Brunt, actually, about 400 block of Van Brunt or 500 block along in there, and there's a lot of these little brick bungalows there where a lot of Italians lived at the time. And so they were always going back and forth between each other's houses, and so they dug a tunnel between the two so they didn't have to go outside. And he thinks that's where the rumor started, that there was always tunnels between the mob family's houses.
Although no one ever actually found any.
But nobody ever actually found any.
Well, you don't go up to the door and knock on it.
Damn sure don't go up to the door and knock on it.
At least don't do that.
Please,
and don't. And if you did, don't ask him stupid questions like, is there a tunnel between your house and the one right behind you? You know, where Josephine Marlowe, where they bugged it? And,
yeah, you know.
And you guys,
FBI.
Lost Vegas? Is it called Lost Vegas here, yeah, around this neighborhood?
And all your older relatives went to jail for the rest of their lives?
Man, too soon.
Too soon, yes, too soon.
Gary has a favorite nonprofit, and he likes to talk about it. He supports it actively, not only by talking about it, but by donating money to the organization.
I do.
They have great events like golf tournaments.
I donate money and time. Yeah, I bought a hole, and we had Gangland Wire True Crime Podcast on the hole. I got another one coming up, Aaron, the Fraternal Order of Police. I just bought a hole from them, and we put Gangland. We might put Gary Jenkins, attorney at law, because those guys they don't really care so much about hearing my podcasts.
True crime stories.
But true crime stories, because they live them, although we'll have some more of them on the show. I probably will have them put down wills and trusts, because a lot of those guys are needing an estate plan. You know, being a policeman today is a little bit dangerous. You probably ought to prepare for your death.
It's really gotten a lot more dangerous.
It's gotten a lot more dangerous, I tell you what. I talked to these guys today, and I don't know. They just, the ones that work the street, they don't know what to do, Aaron. They just really don't know what to do. Be damned if you do and be damned if you don't. So they're doing the best job they can. I like.
They want to come home alive like anybody else.
Right. They do, but yet you got you took on a certain obligation to do certain things, and there comes a certain risk with those things. So I don't know. I guess I'm glad I'm not doing it today. This is dangerous enough, yeah, making people mad every once in a while.
You start talking about their families.
Yes.
The history of the mob.
Anyhow, one of my favorite nonprofit is First Call. If you have a relative, a child, a spouse, a parent, or anybody you care about, they have a problem with addiction, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. Or you can go to www.firstcallkc.org. And even if you're from outside the area and you don't know any other place to go, you can always Google, you know, addiction problems and look for this kind of an agency in your own area. I would look for the nonprofit and then go from there and see if they can steer you to some place that they, you know, deal with, that they know about. There'll be scammers out there in this area. Just call this number and say, you know, I live in, you know, Cincinnati.
In Chicago.
Chicago, you got any resources up here? You can make any suggestions for me, because I have this friend, relative, or if, you know, you yourself may have a problem with drugs or alcohol. I was talking to a narc the other day, Aaron. I was wondering about this whole heroin thing. What's the deal? And what she told me, and she's been doing narcotics. She worked for me in the intelligence unit when I was a sergeant, and she had ended up, she got promoted to sergeant herself and came back into street narcotics for a while and then into administrative narcotics. So she's been doing this for, I don't know, 15 years now. She said the deal is young people, especially suburban young people, are getting their parents, Percocet and oxycodone and Oxycontin, those kinds of
prescription medications.
Prescription medications, and they're using them. Well, they have clamped down. You only get away with that so long, and the feds have clamped down on the process to get script and go fill the scripts. Used to be you could just, if somebody stole a pad of scripts, you could just go write your own script out and go to a
pharmacy
and get it filled. And now it's all by computer, and it's really tightly controlled, so they can't get oxycodone or Oxycontin like they once did. And they can only get so many from their parents or their grandparents or friends or whatever. Now, there is a certain market in that, but heroin has been imported so much, and there's so much out there that it's much cheaper and easier to get than Oxycontin or oxycodone, prescription narcotics, and it has the same effect. And it's different than crack cocaine. Crack cocaine, you had to keep hitting the pipe about every 30 minutes. You had to hit that pipe. Well, with heroin, smoking heroin or shooting it or whatever, it lasts a lot longer. You can stay in that mellow place and not feel the need for some more for 2 or 3 hours, maybe even as much as 4, depending on your tolerance and what's built up. And so that's the reason heroin has gotten so big.
But isn't it just as addictive?
It's just as addictive, and it's a difficult one. You can hold a job because you're not like staggering around. You're not like, you know, go have a heroin on your breath. You know, people don't smell it. Then turn your eyes all red. You can pretty well maintain. If you think about it, Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead was a heroin addict and, you know, fully functioning musician all of his life. So you can, I suppose, if you can deal with it,
Was it Ray Charles?
Ray Charles, yeah.
I mean, if you've watched that movie, it's a great movie.
It is.
But
it
he's
is.
A heroin addict.
Whole life, but yet still put out good music. Now, everybody can't do that, and a lot of people are more susceptible and will just need more and more, and pretty soon they get lackadaisical and they miss work and they lose their job or something crashes down around their head where they don't have any money, and so then they're shoplifting and doing anything they can.
Yeah, and then their family's calling first call.
Then their family's calling first call, and their employer's calling the EAP's calling the treatment center, but it is. She said it's a huge problem, and that's why it is. With the prescription drug thing is computerized now. It's all via computer.
So a doctor writes you a script, but he types it into the computer.
Right.
Sends
and
it
then it's sent. And so there's good hackers have figured out if they get the DEA number of the doctor, then they can make it look like it's from the doctor. And by hacking in and then sending the script. Spoofing the email.
It can come from the doctor's email address because they just spoof it.
Right, exactly. Or come up with one that's real close. And as long as you get the DEA number off the doctor, then you can generate Oxycontin or prescription narcotics that way. I tell you what, it's like whack-a-mole. That narcotics thing, I've been around for a long time with that. And you know, I started out with heroin and weed and LSD. For young people, and then all of a sudden it's cocaine. You know, it's a powder cocaine for the suburban whites, and it's the crack cocaine for the inner city blacks, and that's, you know, that cuts a wide swath and takes a lot of people out and destroys a lot of, really in the black community, that crack cocaine just about destroyed a lot of the community at the time. So then, you crack on that, and then you go to, you know, now there's heroin. Well, there was meth for a while, and all the bikers were making meth before, but then all of a sudden, every little shit bum in the country's got a meth lab going.
They call them that, meth lab?
Meth lab. And then Mexicans down south of the border start creating these huge big meth labs, and they're importing it up here. It's just crazy. You just can't, as long as there's demand, it's going to happen.
Years ago when I lived in Los Angeles, I shared a house with some folks in the valley there on Roscoe Boulevard, just north of the Van Nuys Airport runway. It was a beautiful like ranch house with a big pool in the back, but there was like a little attached room to the house that was kind of, you would have called it like the pool supply room, except they had it cleaned out, and I guess they were manufacturing like meth out of it. Not at the time that I was living there, but before. And the room just had like this chemical odor to it that never went away.
Yeah. They say if you want to, you think your house that you're getting ready to buy might have ever been used to cook meth, don't buy it. Don't buy it. I had a guy call me once, and he said, I'm thinking about buying this little house down in Belton as rental property. He said, but I heard that they served a search warrant there one time. Can you check on that? So I called around. I found out. Called him back. I said, man, don't buy that house. That used to be a meth cooking place, and you'll never get that shit out of there.
Yeah.
It just needs to be torn down. All right, well, I think we're done. We've talked about John Lazy and narcotics problems and a variety of different things. You got anything else, Aaron?
Well, we've got our rip from the headlines, so you got to follow that. These are special extras that we're doing for Gangland Wire. Not only are we doing rip from the headlines, where we raid classic news stories, we are also doing Most Wanted Wednesday.
Yeah, I have to put that up when I get home tonight.
And we talk about some of the most wanted criminals. Now we talk about the FBI or the Marshal Service. I think we might find criminals all over the world,
yes,
if we look around enough.
Yes.
And every Wednesday we'll share that with you, and hopefully maybe we'll bring somebody in. Also, if you love the podcast, please remember to subscribe to the iTunes. Remember to share it. Remember to give us some comments and feedback, because all of that helps us. And remember to rent the movie that started it all, the documentary Gangland Wire, or you can buy it on Amazon, as well as getting the DVD, or buy a T-shirt to help Gary out. He's got electric bills to pay.
Yeah. And
he's got an electric house and an electric car.
I do. Go to our shop page and buy those two episodes. They're only $1.99. If we get a bunch of you guys, we'd even get a fourth of the listeners we've got to buy that, it would be an immense help. Since we don't have enough quite to get an advertiser yet, that $1.99 would be an immense help. And you would get two free episodes.
And remember to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. You can take your own personal tour of Kansas City to notorious mob locations, or better yet, for a low, low fee of $200. If you're here in Kansas City, you and up to four of your friends can spend a couple hours riding around in a vehicle with Gary Jenkins, getting your own personal mob tour from the man who helped bring him down.
We can do that. We can see where Johnny Lazy was gunned down. We can see the bullet holes at the Union Station. We can do a lot of things.
We could drive by the Pendergast office.
We can go see where the Spiro brothers were shot up at the Virginian, and you can see across the street where we were running surveillance 24 hours a day for about a month, and then just quit running surveillance when Tuffy and Joe Ragusa and Charlie Mortina came in the back door and killed Mike Spiro, wounded Joe, and crippled Carl as he ran across the street. He would have been running right into our apartment building when he got gunned down.
If he'd been able to open the door.
Yeah, right. We'd open the door and let him in. But we were gone. We got tired of watching.
Well, the guy, they shot him. He died there, and the cops were on the scene, and they asked him who did it, and he wouldn't tell.
He knew who did it, too. All right, Aaron. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Find them on Facebook at Odd-O-Matic Music.